altogether. Now I shall go to bed a lucky girl, and dwell on these things, and the happiness of belonging to you, and in the hope of your safe return to me. A few minutes after landing, Spencer and the team were walking down a narrow path. Leading the way were the Northern Alliance soldiers. They walked with a steady, assured gait in the dark, even under the burden of the heavy bags of horse feed and numerous extra bags of gear that had come off the helicopter. Bringing up the rear, Captain Mitch Nelson could hear the vodka bottles clinking. He hoped none of them broke before he could present them to Dostum. "Where's the general?" he asked a man walking beside him. Nelson spoke in Russian. Nelson guessed that some of the fighters had learned the language during the Soviet occupation. The man told him that the general was not in camp. He said he was expected soon, in the morning. Nelson let the subject drop, seeming satisfied. He was disappointed that Dostum had not been there to greet them. It was important to appear upbeat, determined, focused. Everything he did, the way he ate, the way he talked, the questions he asked, would be scrutinized by the locals. He looked at the dozen Afghan men accompanying him, and he didn't trust one of them. But he knew his success depended on working with them. He wondered how General Dostum would receive him. Back at K2, Colonel Mulholland had raised the specter that Dostum might even kidnap the entire team and hold them for ransom to the highest bidder. As team captain, Nelson had the job of getting inside Dostum's head and predicting what he would do, even before Dostum himself knew. He had to convince the warlord that the Americans were here to fight and win. The truth was, without Dostum, they'd be annihilated by the larger Taliban army. With him, they had a chance. They had walked about 300 yards when Nelson saw a mud fort silhouetted against the sky. He halted. Somehow he'd been expecting a longer night's march. He was sweaty and tired of lugging his ruck, but it occurred to him that maybe he and his men were walking straight into a trap, an ambush. It was possible that JJ had been taken hostage by the Afghans now accompanying them. They could walk inside, where they'd be attacked. "What's the name of this place?" he asked JJ. "The Alamo." Not necessarily a reassuring name for a refuge. JJ explained that the fort would serve as the team's safe house. JJ seemed at ease. Nothing seemed wrong about the situation. The fort looked like something out of the American Old West. A crescent moon painted its walls dim silver. Each of the walls was made of smooth mud. They measured about 200 feet long and stood 8 feet high. 5 wooden doors were spaced along the front. In the middle stood a wooden gate, wide enough for a team of oxen and a wagon, or a tank, to roll through. A hitching post for horses stood outside the gate. The individual wooden doors were short, maybe only 5 feet high. The Northern Alliance soldiers stooped and filed inside first. Nelson and the rest of the team stared at the small entrance, their guns slung across their chests, fingers curled around triggers. Nelson went in next. Behind him, the tall guys on the team like Spencer and Milo had to struggle through by inching with their overstuffed rucksacks in the narrow opening. Once inside, Nelson scanned the 200-foot-wide courtyard. Off to one side was a large, freshly dug hole with dirt piled on one side, about 6 feet high. A shovel was stuck up in the dirt. Nelson figured this was a water well the Afghans were digging. Along the right side of the courtyard, several rooms had been built out from the exterior wall. It was impossible to tell how old the place was, Fortresses like this one had been constructed in the 19th century as British garrisons, or as defensive outposts manned by rebelling Afghans. The place smelled old, dry, dusty. Scattered around were plastic 5-gallon water jugs, and several black nylon bags filled with gear belonging to the CIA team. News of the Americans' arrival spread in camp, and soon some 50 Afghans had stepped from the shadows and stood in front of Nelson and the team. Some wore bandoliers of heavy ammo draped over their shoulders. Nelson thought he'd never seen a rougher bunch of fighters. The guys with the bandoliers looked like they'd stepped out of battle alongside Pancho Villa. Some were barefoot. Others wore sandals, men's dress shoes, or tennis shoes with no laces. The youngest fighter was in his late teens. The oldest was a man in his 50s. Their chapped faces were crowned with colorful scarves, brilliant as peonies, wrapped tight on their heads. Their beards were wild and thick. Nelson said a few words of welcome, speaking in English, as one of the CIA guys, Dave Olson, translated into Dari. The language was filled with explosive sounds, lots of hard consonants like ch and jaze, rising and falling in intensity, like someone chipping excitedly at soft stone. Nelson told them that he and his soldiers had come to attack the Taliban, and that they would supply anything needed to do this job. "This is your war," Nelson told them. "We are here to help you fight it." The Afghans listened, smiling. They seemed neither to believe Nelson nor disbelieve him. It was like talking to the sky. You knew it was there, but not that it was listening. When Nelson was done, the men drifted away to small depressions in the dirt of the courtyard, where they slept uncovered in the cold. JJ led them across the courtyard and down the long front wall to their rooms. There were two, one for gear storage and another for sleeping. The rooms had been swept and neatened. The ceilings were low, only about 6 feet, and the men had to stoop as they walked around inside. The room smelled of dung and animal hair. Nelson turned on his headlamp and saw that the sleeping room had been a horse stable. Crisp, woven carpets had been laid on the flat mud floor. Large, pastel-colored seat cushions had been spread around. Nelson was moved by the precise care with which the place had been made ready. The men dropped their rucks and made a security plan for the night. Ben Milo and Sam Diller would climb up onto the roofs of the rooms in opposing corners of the fort. They would keep in contact by two-way radio and switch out with another team member after 2 hours. As Milo walked to his post, he noticed that an Afghan soldier was following him. Milo was actually trying to find a latrine. Milo turned and said in English that he had to take a piss, and then he pantomimed the motion. The Afghan shrugged and kept following close behind. Milo found two holes dug in a corner of the fort, near a main front gate. The holes were separated by a flimsy wood partition. There was no door. He unzipped, and the Afghan turned his back and waited. The man then followed Milo onto the roof. Milo had to tell him forcefully, using what was called in the army the pointy-talky method of communication, that he needed to leave. The team had made the decision that their security would be their own problem. Milo gave him a gentle shove, but the man wouldn't budge. He stood to Milo's side as Milo settled into guard duty, which involved scanning the horizon for anything that looked like it shouldn't be there. Lights, movement, sounds. He could hear footfalls outside the fort's walls as Dostum's men roamed back and forth, also on lookout. Milo wondered what was making his new friend so anxious. He wondered if the soldier was planning to whack him. He settled in for an uneasy night. Down in the courtyard, JJ and Nelson sat on a carpet near the half-dug water well, as Nelson peppered the CIA officer with questions about Dostum. JJ told Nelson that he'd been surprised to learn that Dostum moved around the country by horseback. They were practically a 19th-century militia, fighting a modern war. Dostum's men were low on bullets and needed blankets and food. The previous 2 weeks of U.S.-led bombing of Taliban positions had done nothing but lower their morale. Only the United States propaganda machine seemed more organized. From transport planes circling the country, fitted with banks of electronic listening gear and a broadcast radio station, the Americans had been beaming messages to the Afghan people, messages the Taliban found comical. Surrender, Taliban invader. Give Afghanistan back to her people. Nonetheless, Dostum had remained pragmatic and energetic. This surprised Nelson. He said he thought Dostum was crippled with diabetes and failing eyesight, among other things. He was worried that he'd keel over as soon as the fighting started. The truth was, Nelson learned, that no one had been paying much attention to Dostum before the attacks on September 11. He was, in fact, healthy as a horse. Until the previous April, he'd been comfortably living in exile in Turkey with his family. He was married with two young sons. He had returned in the spring when Massoud was losing ground in the Panjshir Valley, and as Mohakik struggled in the south, in the area where Nelson and JJ were now sitting, the Daryasuf Valley. Dostum had arrived to try to save the day. It was meant to be a triumphant return. His exile from the country 4 years earlier, in 1997, had been ignominious. He'd been driven from the city of Mazar-i-Sharif, his stronghold, as the result of a double cross by one of his own commanders, a man named Ahmed Malik. Malik had suspected that Dostum had been responsible for his brother's death, an accusation Malik could never prove. And in revenge, Malik made a deal with the Taliban to let them enter Mazar-i-Sharif and capture the town, as long as he could share power with them in the aftermath, and as long as they kicked Dostum out of Afghanistan. As the Taliban poured into the city, Dostum had to flee for his life. He sped in a small convoy of remaining supporters to the border town of Hayratan, 45 miles north of Mazar-i-Sharif. From this city, a bridge led across the Oxus River to safety in neighboring Uzbekistan. Upon reaching the bridge, Dostum was forced out of his vehicle at gunpoint. Manning the checkpoint were Malik's men, who relished this insulting turn of events for the previously omnipotent warlord, a man whose own home in Mazar was palatial by comparative terms, with flocks of peacocks imported from France wandering in the gardens, and American liquor stocked in crystal decanters on mahogany bars. Dostum and his men had to drop their weapons, empty their pockets of money and valuables, and walk across the bridge in shame. The men guarding the bridge taunted them as they left. With Dostum out of the picture, Malik, however, had experienced a sudden change of heart, and decided he didn't want to share power with the Taliban after all. After the Taliban moved into the city as victors, Malik launched an attack. He was aided by 5,000 Hazara troops, eager to avenge centuries-old animosity between themselves and the traditional ruling class of Afghanistan, the Pashtuns, who made up the Taliban ranks. The Hazaras were led by a fierce warlord named Ismail Khan, Mohakik's predecessor. And alongside Malik's men, this combined force killed between 6,000 and 8,000 Taliban in a matter of several weeks. A year later, remustered and reloaded, the Taliban returned with a vengeance. At 9 a.m. on August 8, 1998, they entered Mazar-i-Sharif, firing their weapons wildly in the air. The locals in the middle of the city thought the gunfire was the sound of yet another sectarian gun battle. When they looked up from their work, they saw hundreds of trucks racing through the dirt streets bearing Taliban fighters, all of them dressed in their usual black turbans. This was their first signal that something was terribly wrong. Some of the trucks had machine guns bolted in the back, and men leaped up at the mounts and started firing wildly, spraying the street, houses, anyone caught in the open. "I came out of my shop," recounted one resident, "and I could see people fleeing. People were running and being hit by cars. Market stalls were overturned. I heard one man say, 'It's hailing,' because of the bullets." By early afternoon, the Taliban started searching house to house for Hazaras. They broke down doors, smashed TVs, tore paintings from the walls, and dragged men into the street and shot them. They broke into hospitals and slit the throats of Hazara patients. They raped Hazara women, who ate handfuls of rat poison in the aftermath, preferring death to the shame of their violation. Broadcasting from loudspeakers around the city, they urged residents to convert on the spot from the Shia version of Islam, the Hazara's own, to the Sunni brand, practiced by the Taliban. "Last year you rebelled against us and killed us," explained one Taliban announcer. "From all your homes you shot at us. Now we are here to deal with you." Cars were stopped at checkpoints, and anyone possessing weapons was arrested. "How many Taliban did you kill in Mazar?" they taunted. If the suspect could prove that he was a Pashtun or a Tajik, the other main tribe in the area, either by reciting his prayers in the Sunni manner or by producing an ID card listing his religious affiliation, he was let go. Otherwise, he was executed. Residents throughout the city heard an ominous warning on their transistor radios. "Wherever you go, we will catch you. If you go up, we will pull you down by your feet. If you hide below, we will pull you up by your hair." Burial of the dead was forbidden. Bodies piled up in the streets. Residents who tried fleeing the city were cut down on the highway by Taliban jet fighters, holdovers from the Soviet era of occupation. So many people died in the road that cars had to drive over the bodies. No one imagined the city could fall so quickly, least of all Malik, who was now a hunted man, a man with his own share of blood on his hands. One of his counterparts, a Hazara named Al-Mazari, had invented what came to be known among Afghans as the Dead Man's Dance. The macabre practice involved beheading a captured Taliban soldier, pouring gasoline down his neck, and then lighting the fuel. The flaming corpse would jerk and writhe, a life-size puppet crackling in its own juices. Malik managed to escape a similar fate and fled Mazari Sharif. He took temporary refuge in Iran. In 1999, Al-Mazari was captured by the Taliban, tortured, and thrown from a helicopter. As for Dostum, he had escaped death thus far by switching sides whenever his own seemed to be losing. He was a volatile sovereign, but he remained a genial opportunist, and it was this trait that made him a pliable ally. When Nelson looked up from the conversation, it was nearly dawn. He and JJ had talked for almost 3 hours. JJ explained that Dostum would be riding into camp at 8 that morning. Nelson looked at his watch. He was anxious about the meeting. There were still several hours to wait. He climbed up on one of the roofs overlooking the compound to get the lay of the land. The fort was positioned atop a 500-foot hill on the east side of the valley. It was nestled in close against a copse of poplar trees, their trunks growing tall and straight, towering above the walls, They looked as big around as flagpoles, and their branches clicked against each other in the rising morning breeze. A half mile away, a river winked in the morning sun. This was the Amu Darya, the rushing course they had followed south in the helicopter. Swift, vinegar-hued shadows raced across the valley floor to the river, hit the opposite valley wall, and climbed out of sight. Up the valley, Nelson knew that perhaps as many as 15,000 Taliban troops were dug into countless hidey holes, hilltops, and fortified bunkers capable of holding hundreds of men. Behind him lay the unfettered wilds of deeper Afghanistan, stark mountain country, a land accessible only by donkey and horse. The plain was packed mud, nearly blonde in color, striped with swaths of grazing grass along the river. Nelson heard a rooster crow, and he thought that this landscape seemed like something in a John Ford movie. He remembered watching those movies as a kid. In college, he'd even kept a poster of John Wayne on his dorm room wall. Now he heard horses neigh in a paddock attached to the fort, and they stamped the ground. And he wondered if he and his men would be riding soon across the wild country before him. Mitch Nelson was standing near the fort doorway alongside Pat Essex when he heard Spencer outside the wall shout, "Pat, Mitch, you better get out here." Spencer had just stepped outside, holding a cup of coffee and wondering when Dostum would show up. He suddenly heard the beat of hooves, felt a thudding vibration in the warm ground beneath his brand new hiking boots. Then he looked up to the surrounding hills and saw men popping up in the sun, crouching there in ragged, loose-fitting black pants, scarves wrapped around their heads. These were lookouts, he guessed, as they began signaling down the valley the arrival of something or someone by firing their AKs in the air. The sharp reports rang in the still morning and moved down the valley toward where Spencer stood. Then seven riders stormed up and shouted, "He is coming! The general is here!" And they waved back, down along the white rocks in the riverbed, a thin tongue of green water lolling under the sun, wiggling its way downstream. Spencer took the last swig of coffee from the metal cup he'd pulled from his rucksack, knocked the cup dry against his pants leg, then called again over his shoulder to Nelson and Essex. Inside the fort, Essex turned to Milo, Diller, and Black. "We're going to go outside," he said. "You guys stay here, and you be ready in case something goes wrong. You be ready to take care of business." Diller and the rest nodded. They took up positions in the four corners of the fort, on the roofs. Essex and Nelson walked out the door and over to Spencer. "He's here," said Spencer. "Where?" said Essex. "There he is," said Spencer, nodding upriver. A white horse emerged from a curtain of dust. The man in the saddle, immense, strong-shouldered, holding the reins in one hand, while his other rested gently on his leg, looked straight ahead, the horse churning beneath him while the man floated atop. Riding along the edges of the river, their gear and weapons clattering, were about 50 more horsemen. They entered the camp and pulled up in front of the Americans. They sat atop their horses and looked down at them. "Oh boy, here we go," thought Essex. "We either just got a whole lot of new friends, or we're surrounded." The lead horseman wheeled his horse to a halt, and the animal stilled as if turned to stone. Nobody moved. Nelson, Essex, and Spencer had no idea what was going to happen next. Two Afghans ran out and grabbed the reins, and the tall, dark-haired man swung off the saddle. He was wearing a long, gray woolen robe, slit up the sides, a red smock, turban, and leather riding boots. I am General Dostum, he boomed in English. I am glad you have come. Nelson, Essex, and Spencer were standing in a line, their weapons slung across their chests, their hands at their sides, a sign of comfortable submission, trust, and readiness. Out of the corner of their eyes, they watched Dostum's men, waiting for them to make any sudden movement with their guns. The big man walked up and stopped before Nelson. The general was over 6 feet tall, weighing maybe 240 pounds. He had a short beard peppered with gray, and limpid eyes that swirled into dark focus as he gazed at Nelson. An honor, said Nelson. He put his right hand over his heart and said, Salam alaikum. Peace be unto you, brother. And peace be upon you, friend, said Dostum. Now we will go and kill the Taliban. Nelson breathed a sigh. They hadn't been killed or kidnapped. Yet. The general burst into the fort in a flurry of shouts and orders, and immediately several attendants spread two carpets on the dirt berm near to the water well. On closer inspection in the daylight, Nelson saw that the hole was quite large, about 30 feet across, and that it was filled with chalky green water, probably fed by a spring bubbling at the bottom. Nelson guessed it also contained rainwater, though rainfall in this part of Afghanistan was less than 4 inches a year. The crude hole was meant to supply drinking water for the camp. Nelson remembered the filters they'd bought by phone from a camping store, all while sitting in the comfort of their team room back at Fort Campbell. Those days seemed a long time ago. The general's attendants set ornate glass bowls containing pistachios, almonds, apricots, and chocolates on the carpets. They bowed swiftly and left, refusing to meet Nelson's eyes. Nelson watched as an aged Afghan man in an outdoor kitchen in a corner of the courtyard drew a brass kettle from a fire. Nelson was starved and wanted to reach and grab a handful of the food. He resisted the urge, realizing it would be rude. He watched as the old man hobbled from the fire with the kettle, trailing a rich plume of steam, and knelt at the carpets. With great ceremony, he poured pale yellow tea into chipped cups set in saucers. Nelson realized the ceremony was as old as war itself. Some corner had been turned. He and his men were inside a guerrilla camp. They were guerrilla fighters now, and they were about to meet their warlord. Dostum sat first, taking a seat at the head of the red and green carpets. The berm's elevation above the floor of the courtyard, about 5 feet, gave the 47-year-old general a commanding view of the goings-on around him. Nelson sat next, to his left, a place of honor, while Spencer crouched down beside Nelson on his knees. JJ, dressed in green camo pants, green shirt, and hiking boots, hovered at Dostum's shoulder. Nelson and Spencer made a display of unslinging their rifles and laying the stout, lethal-looking M4s with their muzzle ends pointing away from the center of the group on the carpets beside them. They kept their 9mm pistols holstered and strapped to their right legs. They were dressed in U.S. Army tan fatigues, with their insignias and names removed, as they had been for the flight in by helicopter. This was a reminder to them that their mission was classified, and that only a few people in Afghanistan, including the men around this camp, and only select military planners back in the United States, knew that they were here. Nelson had tucked a black and white cotton scarf inside his shirt, a first attempt at donning the local mufti. He and Spencer had started growing beards a few days earlier at K2, but they both looked pale, sunburned, and bleary-eyed from too little sleep. Nelson wore a loose, wide-brimmed boonie hat that flopped down over his eyes, while Spencer's billed parade cap was pushed back at a jaunty angle. They watched patiently as one of Dostum's advisers, a stocky, studious-looking man in black wire-rimmed glasses and groomed beard, took a seat at Dostum's right. Next to the advisor, across from Spencer, was Dave Olson, sitting with one leg cocked up, his arm resting on his knee, as if at a campfire. He was wearing a traditional black shalwar kameez over green camo pants. Olson planned to translate when the advisor couldn't find the words. After everyone was seated, they were ready to begin. Nelson cleared his throat and explained to General Dostum that he had a gift for him. The gift was from all the people of the United States, he said, but he was honored to present it personally. He gestured to the bags of horse feed stacked nearby in the courtyard. Someone on the team had tried sifting through the grain and picking out the worms. Dostum looked at the bags, and then back at Nelson. Olson translated. "I don't need food for my horses," Dostum snorted. "My men are hungry. They also need blankets." Spencer could see that Nelson was taken aback. Spencer and Essex had agreed they would keep an eye on the less experienced Nelson. They'd have to guide him through awkward moments like this, when offhand statements might carry larger portents. Was General Dostum unhappy? It was impossible to tell. "General," Spencer spoke up, "we have brought you another gift." And here he reached into one of the black bags brought off the helicopter and produced a bottle of Russian vodka. Dostum's eyes widened. Spencer looked over at Nelson as if to say, "This is how you do it." "Very good," said Dostum. "Excellent." He set the bottle down next to him and regarded the two Americans carefully. He held up one finger. "But what I really need," he said, "is bombs." "Sir," Nelson said, "we have all kinds of bombs. I got more bombs than you could ever want." "We will need them all," he said. He let the matter hang in the air. He sat back. He had a way of looking straight into Nelson's eyes that was unsettling. "And what will you need to drop these bombs?" he asked. "Well," said Nelson, "first off, we need to see the enemy. We need to get up close, real close." Dostum considered this. "I can take you to my mountain headquarters," he said. He had just returned from there. The windswept outpost was located 6 miles up the valley, and there was much Taliban activity in the area. He reached beside him and produced a rolled-up tube. He snapped it flat on the carpet. It was a topographical map, the biggest map of Afghanistan Nelson had ever seen. It measured maybe 6 feet long, creased and tattooed by pencil stub and slashes of ink, smudged with sweat and the ash of cook fires, and crawling with hundreds of arrows marking Taliban positions across the paper's soiled grain. Dostum said he had carried this map for the past month during the fighting at Safid Kota, which was 3.5 miles to the northeast, over the mountain ridge now brightening in harsh morning sun. Nelson's own map was small, practically worthless in comparison. It was at least 20 years old, with tiny blurred print written in Russian. In fact, it had been the map used by the Russians during their occupation, and it had been the only map available to the Americans back at K2. Nelson had thought this was not a good omen, to be carrying a map of the defeated. Dostum scooped up a handful of pistachios and chewed busily, lost in thought, staring at the map. He jabbed at the paper and started speaking rapidly. "The key to controlling the country," he explained, "meant taking Kabul. The key to Kabul was taking Mazar." Nelson and Spencer nodded in agreement. "The key to Mazar," Dostum continued, was taking the Daryasuf River Valley. And if they took Mazar, the north would fall. All six provinces, without question. Next would come Kabul. And with the north in control, you could take Kandahar in the south. In this way, you could capture the country. Dostum sat back and studied Nelson and Spencer. He next laid a broad thumb near the village of Chapchal. It lay 8 miles north of their camp, a wind-scoured, sun-struck place of 500 souls moving through dusty streets and squat mud huts, nestled in a rolling sea of burnt hills. "The Taliban are now here," he said, circling the village with his thumb. The Taliban had retreated to this place after their defeat at Safed Kota. A few roads, little better than goat paths, spidered from the village, a red dot on the general's map. Nelson pointed to another village, Dehi, about 2 miles north of them, also up the valley. Nelson asked if Dehi was safe. Dostum smiled. "But of course, I have captured it last week." After a fierce skirmish with the Taliban, he had ridden through the village, stopped outside the houses while still astride his horse, and announced to the men inside that they should fight for him, that he would pay them for this, that they had nothing to fear from him, that they should fear only the Taliban. "Let me tell you a story," Dostum said to Nelson. "When I heard of the attacks in the United States, my heart broke." He had been living in an apartment in the village of Chobaki, north of Chapchal, about 12 miles from where he and Nelson now sat. From this makeshift headquarters, he could look out with binoculars and see the Taliban front lines just 1.5 miles away. He shook his head. That's how far north his front line had once extended. He had lost all that ground in the fighting since then, in about 2 months. He had been in his apartment listening to the radio when news of the attacks in America broke in. He called an old friend and fellow Afghan, a man named Zalmay Khalilzad, who just happened to be the United States ambassador to Afghanistan, living in Washington. "Zalmay," he said, "tell the American friends that as far as they have hard enemies, they should know that they have hard friends, too, and that they are us." And then he hung up and went back to fighting the Taliban. But for the next 5 weeks, the enemy had beaten him back down the valley, mile by mile. "We are now here," he said. He dragged his thumb south along the Daryasuf River, where the current churned over car-sized boulders and trilled in silver braids, and stopped near Dehi. "I want to move today to my mountain headquarters, overlooking Chapchal. From there we will bomb the Taliban. Once the bombing starts, they will break." Then he announced quite unexpectedly, "We will leave immediately." Nelson asked how he was so sure of his plan. "The Taliban are like slaves," he said. "They are slaves because they are forced to fight. They threaten to kill a soldier's family if he does not fight." He explained that many Afghans in the Taliban army, which numbered as high as 50,000, were farmers, teachers, shopkeepers, men conscripted into service, men who fought because they were scared. The foreign Taliban, on the other hand, the Pakistanis, the Saudis, the Chechens, even the Chinese, they were fierce men, ferocious fighters. They had infested the country from radical madrasas in Pakistan. They were often joined by bin Laden's Al-Qaeda army. Bin Laden's men pulled out grenades and blew themselves up rather than be captured. They called themselves the O-55 Brigade, a crack squad of 500 to 600 stormtroopers. They were not accepted by the Taliban ranks, who considered them foreigners. In camp, they did not mix. Each group kept to itself, They did not fight for Afghanistan. They fought to convert the world to Islam. The Taliban fought to change Afghanistan. When we capture the Afghan Taliban, said Dostum, they switch sides, and they start fighting for us, and we let them live. As for the Arab Taliban, he went on, the foreigners, they prefer death. You can't capture them. You must kill them. They never give up. Recently, one of Dostum's spies, living in Mazar-i-Sharif, had contacted him by satellite phone, telling him that he could see more Taliban soldiers in the streets gathering in Toyota trucks. They were shouldering battered AK-47s, shotguns, RPGs, PK machine guns, machetes, sticks and swords, obviously getting ready to fight. Dostum had given away some 15 satellite phones to spies across the north, from Herat in the west to Kunduz in the east. They were handsomely paying off. The spy was speaking to him at great risk. Taliban soldiers had shown up at his house and told him, "You're coming with us." To save his life, he had joined with the religious fighters. Now, after several months of being forced to battle Dostum, he was getting his revenge. The spy told Dostum that hundreds of men were loading into T-55 tanks and a similar Russian-made fighting vehicle called a BMP, Bimpy for short. He could hear the snort of their diesel engines tearing out of the gates of the city, heading down the rutted road to a place called The Gap, a notch in the mountain wall that separated Mazar from the country's interior. The Taliban were pouring through the gap, headed toward Dostum, here in this valley. Thousands of fighters, coming at them like a storm. "There is a bounty on your heads," he went on. $100,000 for your body. $50,000 for your empty uniform." Dostum said this flatly, without emotion, as if testing a response. Nelson wondered why Dostum was suddenly telling him this ominous news. Was he suggesting he owed Dostum a favor for not ransoming them to the Taliban? Nelson and Spencer were shocked by the general's bloodlust and eagerness. In fact, Dostum had warned his men, "You will guard the Americans. If you fail, you will be killed." It had been Nelson and Spencer's experience, training some armies in Middle Eastern countries, that the soldiers were loath to start fighting. They had half expected Dostum to explain 100 reasons why his men weren't ready. In this way, he'd prolong America's presence and subsist on foreign aid. Spencer leaned over to Nelson. "Jesus," he said, "this guy's ready to roll. He wants to win." "We will leave now," Dostum insisted. "I will take you to my mountain headquarters." "What do you think?" said Nelson. "I think you should go," said Spencer. "It's risky." "I know it is. We just got here." "Hell, it isn't anything you can't figure out." Nelson turned to Dostum. "Can I take my men?" Dostum nodded. "All of them, everybody," Nelson insisted. "We're all going with you?" Dostum shook his head again. "No, no, there are not enough horses." "Unless we all go," Nelson told Spencer, "we're not leaving." He turned to Dostum. "How far a ride is it, General?" Dostum said it would take several hours. "We can split the team," said Spencer. "We got radios?" "Barely enough, but we got radios." "You think he's up to something?" asked Nelson. "Hard to say." "How many men can I take?" "Six," said Dostum. "You can take six." "Horses are hard to come by in this country, aren't they?" Nelson said. Dostum didn't understand. Nelson looked over at the horses, standing patiently at the fort's entrance. They were shaggy and thin-legged and short, roan, white, and gray. In this country, Nelson knew, a man measured his wealth in horses, Each one might cost about a year's wages, $100. These were horses descended from the beasts Genghis Khan had ridden out of Uzbekistan, and from farther north, Mongolia. Deep-chested, short-legged animals, built for mountain walking. Nelson counted about 50 in the string, roughly one for each man in camp. He guessed that they had ridden them from home to war. "When would we leave?" Nelson asked. At this, Dostum stood up quickly. "In 15 minutes." Before Nelson could stop him, the delighted general had barked orders to his men bent at various tasks in the camp. They dropped what they were doing, walked to their horses, and began saddling them. Within several minutes, they were seated atop the mounts and ready to ride out. Nelson yelled to the team's alpha cell, composed of Sam Diller, Vern Michaels, Bill Bennett, Sean Coffers, and Patrick Remington. "You better get out here." The men stepped from their quarters. They quickly gathered around the berm. "Pack your shit." "We're leaving?" asked Diller. "We're going to the front lines." The five men hurried to their rucksacks in the gear room and pawed through clothing, food, ammo, and water, winnowing an essential load to stuff in their green day packs. They came lugging them back to the center of the courtyard. They stood stone-faced, with their rifles slung on their shoulders, pistols strapped to their legs by means of wide black elastic bands. They looked around the courtyard at the Afghans, gazing back at them. They wore black watch caps, pulled down over greasy, stringy hair. A few had tucked Afghan scarves around their collars. Nobody wore a helmet. Helmets were bulky and heavy. For this same reason, nobody had on body armor either, those 40-pound Kevlar vests. "How are we getting there?" asked Diller. "Horses."
"Horses?"
"Yeah. We're riding there." As they spoke, Dostum, across the courtyard, swung into his saddle. The men turned to watch him. The general sat atop his white stallion, a red pom-pom braided in the coarse ivory hair at its forehead. He carried a soft green blanket and a red carpet lashed to the back of the saddle. Lined up beside him were a dozen of his men. Their horses stamped the ground, raising and dropping their heads like hammers. They were stallions, all of them.
"He's fixing to leave without us," said Nelson. "We better goddamn hurry up."
Dostum touched his stallion's flanks with his boots, rode over to Nelson, and stopped. He looked off to the distant mountains, then turned back and to Nelson. "I cannot guarantee your safety in Dehi," he said. "There are people there who are not happy about your arrival." So said the voice of God. In a different time, in the year 1418 in the Muslim calendar, John Walker Lind pushed through the glass front doors of the Mill Valley Mosque into the night. On his right, a parking lot, eucalyptus trees. A few cars parked inside under the sulfurous glow of sodium lights. High chain link, topped with concertina wire. Light traffic on a street in a part of town filled with modest homes, discount stores, and auto parts. Beyond that, the wave-like roar of interstate traffic, headed south to L.A., or north along the coast. He kicked off on his mountain bike, a new man, headed home. It was at least a hard hour's ride. When he pulled up in front of his parents' house in San Anselmo, he went inside without saying so much as a word, went directly upstairs to the bathroom, reached in and turned on the shower, undressed. It was September 27, 1997, in the year of the Christian Lord, the God his father worshipped. His mother said she was a Buddhist. He and his father were two continents drifting apart. It was a Saturday,
a day he would not forget. He was 16. Back at the mosque, he had stood before the meager huddle of supplicants gathered on the prayer rugs. His friend Nana, brown faces in the crowd, men all. Pakistanis, Arabs, mostly Indonesians. Pilgrims in a land of pilgrims. John Walker Lind among them. Lost. He had impressed Nana with his studiousness. When Nana told John that he believed music with a beat was impure, John agreed. When Nana said he didn't use a fork because Muhammad did not use a fork, John ate with his hands. The study group at the mosque debated the Sunnah, which are writings by Muhammad's contemporaries describing what Muhammad said and did. Lind eagerly adopted the teachings of Abd al-Wahhab, an 18th-century Islamic cleric who believed Islam needed to return to a strict interpretation of the Quran. After study, Lind and five other teenagers played putt-putt golf at a local amusement park. In his white flowing robe, his pale face topped with a cotton skullcap, he looked lonely. When they played basketball, he stood watching from the sidelines because he didn't think it fitting to remove his robe in public. More than anything on earth, he wanted to learn Arabic so he could teach English speakers about Islam. He wanted to translate the Quran from Arabic into English. At the mosque, he had stood and said, Shahada, the declaration of his conversion. I declare that there is no God except God, and I declare that Muhammad is the messenger of God. Very good, Lind was told. You are Muslim now. Go home. You must shower, cleanse yourself. When you step from the water, a new man will be in your footsteps. So ends the voice of God. Before Nelson could protest Dostum leaving without them, the warlord spurred his horse. Nelson watched as Dostum and his men clattered through the fort gate. Once they were outside its walls, they let out a whoop, and Nelson listened to the hooves pound, and then silence. An Afghan soldier came walking up the courtyard leading six horses. Nelson tried to put Dostum's warning from his mind. Concentrate. He's messing with you. Who's ridden before? Nelson asked the team. Only Vern Michaels and Bill Bennett raised their hands. At summer camp, they said, when we were kids. The U.S. Army did not offer Horsemanship 101 as a matter of course. It did run a program called Dusty Trails in the Colorado Rockies, but this taught soldiers how to use pack mules in mountain environments. No one in Washington, D.C. had imagined that modern American soldiers would be riding horses to war. Nelson tried picking out the handsomest, tallest one from the string. It had a sugar-white star whorled on its brown forehead. Its rough-haired legs were knobby at the knees and tapered thin as cypress roots at the ankle. The hooves were cracked, unshod, the color of dishwater. In height, it resembled an overlarge pony, the kind children ride at county fairs in a sawdust circle. The man leading the horses said its name was Suman. He gave Nelson the reins. The horse was so short that Nelson could walk right up and look directly in its eyes. He tried figuring out the pedigree. Maybe Arabian bred with quarter horse and a mystery animal that shrunk it one-third the size of a normal horse, at least normal by any standard Nelson was used to. 2 months earlier, back at home on leave, he'd ridden out across his father's property in Kansas on a big chestnut quarter horse on a warm summer day. Miles of tall wheat whispering against the horse's legs as they passed. He could turn in the saddle and look back to his parents' house, where his wife Jean waited. She was pregnant with their first child. He worried about Gene having the baby without him while he was gone. Most people didn't think soldiers cared about that kind of thing, but Nelson did. He had sat through endless sonograms and well baby checkups. Before being deployed, Spencer's wife, Marcia, had volunteered to be Gene's labor coach, and he'd been relieved. Looking in this horse's eyes, which seemed to contain all the misery and the patience from misery in the world, he knew the future for him had narrowed to include just a thin slice of staying alive through the next day. The wives, though, they had the rest of their lives to worry about, if anything should happen to the men. He tried swinging his boot up in the stirrup, and found it was too high. The stirrups were hammered iron rings, and they hung down from the saddle on short pieces of leather. There was no way to lengthen them. He remembered that the Afghans mounted by swinging up in the saddle. He put his left hand on the stained blanket that formed the saddle seat. It smelled rancid. The saddle was made of three boards, hinged together, covered by goatskin. He reached up with his right hand to the back and grabbed the edge of the stout board underneath the blanket, jabbed his right toe as best he could in the stirrup, and kicked up and swung down. He landed with a groan. The saddle was tiny, made for a much smaller man. Nelson saw that the average Afghan weighed about 140 pounds. No one on his team weighed less than 200. On the saddle, there was no pommel horn to grab onto for balance. He gripped the horse's mane with one hand and held the reins with the other. He lifted a boot and jammed it into a stirrup, then jammed the other boot in. Just the toes caught the edges. He was sitting with his knees practically bent up to his ears. He knew he looked funny. He wondered how in God's name he was ever going to ride this horse. "Listen up," Nelson croaked. "Here's how you make this thing go." He heeled the horse in the ribs, and it walked a few steps. "And here's how you turn," he said, pulling a rein and drawing the narrow muzzle around. "And here's how you stop." He pulled back on the reins and sat looking at the guys. "Got it?" The guys on the team just nodded. "Now if your horse runs off," he went on, "and your boot gets stuck in these stirrups and you get thrown, you'll get dragged, and you'll die. If that happens," he announced, "you gotta shoot the horse. Just reach out and shoot it in the head." The guys were now watching him like he'd lost his mind. "I'm not kidding," he said. "You don't want to get dragged over this rough ground." Several Afghan soldiers walked up to help the men get on their horses. The Afghans held the reins with their left hand and reached over with their right to steady the stirrup so the soldier could slip his boot inside. The horses started moving in counterclockwise circles, forcing the riders to keep up with one boot in the stirrup and the other hopscotching in the dirt. About every third hop, the guy would try to jump up and swing over the saddle. After several minutes, everybody had managed to scramble up. Spencer walked up to Nelson, sitting on his horse. He thought Nelson must be terribly uncomfortable. The young captain looked wedged into the small saddle. "I'm keeping the Bravo cell here," Spencer explained. He was holding behind Pat Essex, Charles Jones, Scott Black, Ben Milo, and Fred Falls. They would run the logistics end of Nelson's journey. "I've got an airdrop scheduled for tonight," Spencer said. "Medical equipment. I'm requesting blankets for Dostum." Nelson nodded. "Man," Spencer said, "you look funny on that horse." Nelson didn't say anything. "We'll keep in hourly contact," said Spencer. "I'll be on the PRC," said Nelson. This was the inter-team handheld radio. "Vern will have the commo package running back to K2. "Mitch?" "Yeah?" "Good luck." "Luck won't have much to do with it." "I know." Nelson kicked his horse in the flanks. Cho, he said, remembering what the Afghans had shouted when they'd ridden away. The word meant giddy up in Dari.